Hi everybody, welcome to Cloud Cover. My name is Chris Reiser. Today I'm joined by Hashi Bai.
Hello.
Hello, Hashi.
Yes.
And today our special guest is Pranav Rastogi. Pranav, what are you going to talk to us about today?
Hi, Chris. So I'm going to be talking to you about today about the WebJobs SDK and some of the improvements that we've done to WebJobs itself. It's been a while since we've talked about it.
Like, absolutely.
So we have some big news that we sort of wanted to share out as well.
Very exciting. All right, so we're going to bypass the news today and go right into your presentation. So let's talk about WebJobs.
Perfect, yeah. So I think WebJobs is a feature that we added to Azure Web Apps last year, which allows you to run sort of these background jobs as part of your Azure Web App. So examples are, I have an image processing site, I enqueue a message, there's a job in the background that picks a message, does some image processing, uploads the result to the blob, and you're done.
And this is part of Azure websites and web apps, which are kind of the same thing.
It's kind of the same thing, right?
Different, so, but they're there in both places.
But they're in both places and stuff. So.
Right.
Right. So as part of this offering, we have the WebJobs SDK as well, which you can use in your .NET console apps, which allows you to trigger a function based on a new queue message on a new blob that's uploaded to a file that's uploaded to a blob container. And so that's what we had as a V1 offering.
And the idea there was that instead of creating a web job, which, when I think of a job, I think of something that's just going to run on a scheduled basis maybe or run on demand. But with that, what you're able to do is create these jobs which are triggered off of, like you said, a blob being uploaded or a message being queued. So instead of you having to say, run this job every 5 minutes to see if there's something in the queue or to see if there's new blobs, you can basically create a job which is automatically triggered when that sort of stuff happens.
Exactly.
Great.
And so that allowed developers to easily use queues in their application because the SDK did the heavy lifting of which queue processing algorithm should I use, how should I dequeue a message, how do I handle poison queues. Mm-hmm. And the developers was then sort of left working with JSON.NET objects and their own custom logic. So they didn't have to worry about the Azure internal. So the SDK was trying to make this developer experience of incorporating Azure resources like blobs, tables, queues, fairly easily into your application and service bus as well.
Great.
So this queuing mechanism is a service bus queue?
So we support both service bus and Azure queues.
Okay.
So you can choose what you want to use in your applications.
But for me to use the web jobs, I don't need to maintain a separate service bus queue. It's done by the WebJobs itself?
It's just by the WebJobs SDK. So you give it a queue name for the queue that you want to listen to, and the SDK will go pull the queue and pull the message out and give you the message that you can use in your application.
Okay. So you still have to create the queue and then put something in it,
yes.
But this will let you kind of
consume it.
But in my web job, I don't need to pull that queue myself.
Right.
It's triggered.
Yeah. Okay. The SDK does that for you. So the developer, you don't have to write the polling algorithm.
Okay.
And so when we released this V1, so we had only support for triggering based on queues, service bus, and blobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire model was closed, basically. But recently, I have this blog post up, which we published last month. We've sort of open sourced the SDK. So it's on GitHub, and we are accepting community contributions.
Great. And we'll make sure links to both this post and that GitHub repo are all beneath the video.
Right. And then the second part of the open sourcing effort was also around opening up this extensibility model so that developers or framework authors can now go and write triggers for various sources. So let's say I want to trigger a function based on a cache item that was uploaded onto Redis.
Mm-hmm.
Or I want to trigger a function based on a file that was uploaded on my file share. It could be Azure files, or it could be a local file system. It could be a file system on Azure Web Apps. But I want to trigger my function on a file. And this was a very common request because I think a lot of applications that do backup. So they get a file, they process it, then upload to a blob, and then they want to be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the SDK sort of allows you to get these scenarios up and running very quickly. And a timer was another example of I want to trigger my function based on a certain timer info and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we've opened up this extensibility model where you can now sort of go write your own triggers and binders. It's an open source project. You can contribute back to it. And as a consumer of these triggers and binders, I can start using these new triggers in my application. So I can trigger a function based on files. I can trigger a function based on timer from a Redis cache. I can do anything in this world.
So now if I go in here and I say, I'm going to create a trigger off something we don't have, right?
Right.
Is there a centralized place for people to push or to contribute back their new triggers and binders?
Yes. And so we have, as part of our open source effort, I'm just going to pull up a repo that we have. So we have three repos, SDK, which is the core, mm-hmm. and then extension is the repo where we are putting in all the new triggers that are coming in. And so we've seeded this repo with the two extensions. So we have over here an example of like files and timers. Mm-hmm. And then I have this another open source project started by Jason Haley, and he's building up on the same extensibility framework, and he's written an extension for Redis.
Okay.
So each time an entry gets inputted into a Redis cache, a function can be triggered, basically.
Okay, great.
So, you know, let's see an example of a trigger in action, and I'll start to show you sort of the benefits that you get as a developer by consuming these triggers.
Great.
So in this project, it's just a console application, and I've gone ahead and I've installed my extensions NuGet package. So we'll just see what are the packages that I've installed. So I've installed this extensions package, which gives me the core extensibility framework, plus it gives me the files trigger, plus it gives me the timer trigger.
Okay.
And we'll just use the timer trigger in my sample. So in my function, you know, this is a very familiar pattern to developers using the SDK. This is the SDK which is running continuously, and you can now trigger functions based on certain events. So I'm going to add timers to this application. So here I'm viewing up the configuration object, and I can say config.useTimers. So this will add the timer trigger. I can also add a verbose logging, which is something that we have added to the framework, is a trace. And so this will allow us to see the output on the console window.
And that's if you go into, where, how do you get into that console window to see that output?
Oh, so when you just launch the process, it's just the...
Okay, so locally when you run it.
Locally when you run it.
Now, yeah. If you leave that on and you push it up to the web job, is there somewhere that output goes then that you can see it?
Yeah, so our recommendation is to use this only in development time scenario, so you can see it running locally.
Right.
When you push it to the cloud, like we would like you to use a text writer.
Okay.
So that these logs are now stored in storage account that you can query over a later point in time.
Great.
And so now in my functions, so this is an existing pattern that we had where we can trigger a function based on a new queue message.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can sort of, you know, very roughly copy the same pattern, and I can say process timer. And then I can, instead of queue trigger, I can start doing timer trigger. And then the timer trigger basically takes, you know, how often do you want to invoke this function. I'm going to say invoke this every like 5 seconds, and it gives me a timer info object back. And I can just write this console.writeline, like, you know, triggered. So in this case, this function is going to be triggered every 5 seconds,
mm-hmm.
basically. So let's run this. And so you'll now start to see the, like in the console, some verbose logging on what functions were detected. So it's the timer trigger that's now running. And so every 5 seconds, you'll see this sort of triggered message being outputted on the screen.
Okay.
And so this is a very basic way of sort of getting started up with the timer trigger. You will see also in the logs that a statement saying renewing singleton lock. And so what that means is basically behind the scenes, let's say you have one web job running in the cloud, and then you decide to scale out your web job to multiple instances.
Mm-hmm.
Now your timer is running on multiple instances, but you don't want that. You maybe just want the timer to run on one instance because that makes sense for a timer.
Mm-hmm.
And so by default, we have this concept of a singleton baked in where the timer is singleton and it only executes on one host. So
okay.
If you scale out across 5, it's going to only work on one host.
Is it always going to be the same host that it's going to run on?
The first one to sort of start.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you can configure it, like, you know, which one. And behind the scenes, we basically have a blob lease that we keep track of if the timer is running, and we keep renewing the lease so that we make sure it doesn't die and stuff.
Okay.
So the SDK does all the heavy lifting for you, and as a developer, you don't have to worry about, like, how do I scale, how do I manage these timer triggers when I scale as well.
Very nice.
And then from a developer experience, now you can sort of have a single web job, and you can have different kinds of functions being triggered on different inputs. So you have like a process queue function being triggered on a new queue message. You have process timer being triggered on a new, like a timer frequency. You have files, you have blobs. And so the manageability experience gets simpler. Okay. Because you have just one console exe, and you have one C# file, and that's it.
You know? So does the queue trigger behave differently from the timer trigger?
Yes.
I mean, when you scale out, it's actually you can have multiple hosts processing the jobs.
So if your queue triggers, let's say you scale out to 5 instances, then it's a parallelized world, so you get it'll execute on all those 5. You can control that and say, hey, I don't want to parallelize my queue trigger. I only want to run it on one instance. And you can have a setting files where you can say, this will only run on one instance as well. And inherently, on each machine that the queue trigger runs on, there's inherent parallelism within the machine based on like how many cores does it have, like how many messages can it receive in parallel from the queue itself. So the SDK does that inherent sort of queue polling and fine tuning of that logic itself.
So very nice.
As a developer, like you really don't have to do anything. So I'm going to start showing you a couple of more examples on like the power of the timer trigger, the power of the files trigger, and then sort of we'll look at some other scenarios as well.
Now, just really quick, though, can you go back to the program.cs for a second? So inside here, all you have to say is use timers, that basically goes in and says it finds the timer function or the process timer function?
Yes. And so this is the new extensibility work that we've done, is where as authors of the extensions, you can write new extensions for like, you know, timers, files, Redis, and then you can give extension methods which developers can use to register your extension in their apps. And effectively what this use timers does is behind the scenes is it discovers functions which have this timer trigger attribute, and then it does its own polling. Like it's basically an in-memory timer which, you know, keeps on this frequency that you specified, it's going to keep executing this function.
But all that's done for you. That seems very, very simple to get up and running.
Yes. As a consumer, you don't have to write that code. Like there'll be some framework author who will write this for you once, and then everybody else can sort of benefit from that.
Very cool.
And I guess when you implement those functions, there would be some constraints, right? Like you can't use the local storage to save.
I mean, as a general best practice in the cloud, we do recommend using storage as your persistence medium. Like Azure Web Apps does provide you with a file system, but that file system is limited in terms of how much data can you store on the files. Mm-hmm. So as a best practice, you should be persistent in the cloud and not rely on local storage as well. Mm-hmm. So none of the SDK concepts guide you towards local storage as well. I mean, queues are storage as well, like timers. Behind the scenes, we take up loblies, so that's again storage. Like we don't maintain some like in-memory representation of the state of your timers. Right. It's a loblies basically that we have.
Great.
So let me sort of show you a couple of quick examples on timers. And part of this integration is we've also support cron expressions. So for those of you who are not familiar with cron expressions, so cron expression is a spec, for the lack of a better word, where you can specify a schedule based on the string representation. And so what this is telling you is, you know, trigger this function every 15 seconds.
Okay.
And you can get really fancy in terms of defining very complicated schedules within the string itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that we support as well.
Okay.
The other support that we have is a notion of you can define your own schedule. So let's say in this case, I'm saying my weekly schedule, and this means, you know, fire me at Monday 8 a.m., fire me twice on Wednesdays at 9:30 and 9 p.m., fire me every Friday at 10 a.m. And I can compose this to be my weekly schedule.
Right. So I could see the scenario here being where if you have very good understanding of like the traffic or what sort of processing capabilities you're going to need or when you're going to need it based off, you know, use of your web application, you could really easily go in here and make up this sort of schedule.
Yes. And the beauty of that is like, you know, once you make up the schedule, like if I go back to my functions, I can always like enqueue a message over here as part of my like timer execution. So in this case, each time this timer fires, I'm going to, you know, write a string message. And so this means, like, I think a common pattern is like to start a workflow at certain point in time. So let's say every Sunday you want to perform a backup operation. So every Sunday you can fire this timer and queue a queue message of the backup operation or the files that you want to backup, and then there you go, basically. So the whole, idea that I'm trying to drive home is the sort of the dev experience and the manageability of certain of these kinds of, you know, infrastructure.
Like, definitely.
I don't have to write multiple jobs. I just have functions which I'm dealing with in a single EXE.
Seems much easier.
Yeah. So.
And it seems so. It seems here that, for the sake of here, what you're seeing is we've got two different kind of almost. Two different sort of processors, but it's just one job, right?
Yes.
So you're not necessarily constrained to one bit of functionality per each job, so you don't have to upload multiple jobs.
Exactly.
You can have it all in kind of one web job project and just
part of it. And it's just a console project. Like there's no magic.
It's very simple.
No special project go. It's like it's literally a console app that you can run locally, as I did, or you can just upload it as a web job using the VS tools, and
great.
You know, it's running on the cloud as well.
Okay.
So now I wanted to show you sort of the files example. So let me just drop in. And all these samples are public.
Okay.
We'll have links to it at the end of our recording. So I'm just gonna So this one is pretty cool actually. So let's see what's happening here. Import some namespaces. So as you saw with the timers, now I have use files.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm specifying what's my root directory where all my files are. So locally, it's c:temp. If you're running in Azure Web Apps, it's like dhome root is your where your file system is. You know, eventually, you'll be able to use Azure Files as well as your file share. And then you can just pass in the connection strings, and everything should work.
Okay.
And then, let me just. This is just a setup where it's just creating all the files that are required.
Okay.
But if I go to my file samples, it has different now logic. So import file. So import file is basically this function will be triggered whenever there's a file in a directory called import, which has any file which has an extension .dat.
Okay.
So that's the pattern. And the function gets triggered, and then I can store the information in a blob. So within like two lines, I'm basically going from files to blob. So that's a common backup operation that people keep doing, like process a bunch of files and archive it.
Yep.
Process, archive, process, archive. this one is an interesting one. Like a lot of people like to play sort of games with text files, like count words, like reverse the contents of the file and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's basically this. Like two triggers, and then I can just call the C# function to reverse the contents of the file, and then I'm basically done. This is a good example of like a heartbeat or a backup scenario where every 5 seconds, this function will get triggered, and I can monitor something. I can monitor if the file exists, doesn't exist, and do some sort of custom operation on it. So, I can build it. I can go to my file share, which is c:temp. And so let's run this. So it generated these files. I'm just going to copy input, and I'm going to add it to convert. And so you'll see behind the scenes that convert got triggered. And then what convert does is it'll write to the converted directory. So I'll go to the converted, and I'll see that the text was basically reversed.
Okay.
And all these timers are again. Now, in the case of files, the timer behaves more like queues. So if you deploy a web job which has a file trigger and you scale out, it's going to process in parallel because that's what you want.
Right.
It's unlike timers where you want a timer to run on a single instance. Maybe files is something more like queues where you want more parallel processing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can control that as well. But the defaults are sort of optimized for what the default experience could be for these timers as well.
Now, if you're scaling out your web application and for your web job, So let's say you write a file in this case that would be processed into the web jobs local or the web apps local storage or the file storage, right?
Yeah.
That would actually only be on one of those instances, right?
Correct.
So it would be whatever the web job running on that same instance would then pick that up.
Yes.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah. Right. And then let me show you on the same, like a Redis extension. And so this extension was built by Jason Haley. He's still sort of polishing it up. That's the first prototype. But effectively, like, he went to the extensions model, you know, and then built up his Redis extension.
Now, is this our first community extension?
That's pretty, actually, yeah, this is our first community extension. And I think this just came in sort of last week.
Oh, great.
Is what came in, and I saw this, you know, tweet go by, like, right. I'm writing the secret extension. I was like, can you send me the URL, please? And yeah. He sent me a URL of the GitHub repo, which was empty, like, last week. And now we have an extension that's sort of running over here. So I just like cloned his project, and you know, effectively what I have is like he has two samples. So effectively, for people who don't know Redis, like Redis is a cache, and Redis has a pub/sub pattern which you could publish to a channel, and there are subscribers that listen to a channel, and then they can get the message.
Okay.
So he's leveraging that functionality, and he has a publisher. So in program CS, you'll see that he's registering his own extension called use Redis, and he's invoking a method called sendMessage, which is going to publish a message on using the Redis pub/sub feature.
Okay.
And in the subscriber side, I have this getMessage, which is listening on this channel called messages, which is what the publisher is publishing to.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as messages are published, then you can sort of you know, get these subscribed as well.
So in the case of the publisher, what's the trigger that actually triggers it to publish a message?
Say that again. Sorry.
So in the case of the publisher sample,
right,
or function, what's the actual trigger for that causes it to actually get run?
Okay, that's a good question. So in my program CS, I have this one line which is saying host.call this function sendMessage.
Okay.
Which is gonna call this function sendMessage, which has a Redis publish attribute, which is gonna publish the message on the Redis cache.
Okay.
That's how it happens.
Okay.
And on the subscriber side, you know, I have host.run and block, which is like sort of a while true loop,
yep,
which is constantly running. And as soon as messages come on this channel, then this function will get triggered. So I'm going to run the subscriber first.
So this will be interesting because in the pub/sub, actually all the subscribers will get the message.
Yes.
Right? So this means you can trigger all
like
the hosts,
yeah,
to do the same job.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so this is the subscriber that got started. I'm going to start the publisher as well. Right, so on the left console, you're seeing that the send message succeeded. And the right, you're seeing that it's executing the get message because a new message was detected.
Mm-hmm.
And then the get message internally enqueued a message as well, which another function, receive and store, was listening as well, so that got executed as well.
Great.
So again, you know, it's a very simple demo, but kind of sort of illustrates the point where in a single exe, now you can have functions which can get triggered based on various events. And based on what your application needs are, you can sort of have an easier maintenance story, an easier publishing story.
Okay, great.
An easier scaling story. Like now you have like one console exe that you need to scale and manage. Like,
mm-hmm. Nice.
Right. So I'm going to show you something very interesting, which I sort of was learning quite a lot. So on this project, like we have we have a developer called Matthew who's been sort of building up all the heavy lifting of the framework features, and he's been super crazy about it. And he just rolled out this singleton, which we released a few days back, in fact.
Okay.
And so this singleton is a scenario where, you know, if you're building cloud applications and you're scaling to different hosts, how do you ensure that this function that you write executes only once across all hosts?
Right.
Like, give me an answer. Like.
Well, I mean, you could use your blob lock file, like you mentioned before, but
yeah,
it's, you know, that's certainly something you might have to write yourself, which can be complicated.
Exactly.
Especially to get it right and tested and all that stuff.
Yeah, and then we are still sort of building it up and trying it out. Like, and so we've now introduced a sort of a notion of a singleton feature in the SDK where you can put the singleton attribute on a function, and which will guarantee that this function will execute only once across all hosts that you've scaled
okay
out to. So that's a start. The second thing that we've added is, which is the cooler part, is the concept of scopes. And so you have this function, let's say, and it's being triggered on this queue message. Depending on the contents of the queue message, you can scope the execution to be singleton.
Okay.
So let's take this example, right? So I have this singleton job, which is getting triggered on this queue message, on the queue called singleton test.
Mm-hmm.
It takes in a queue message of type work item. And work item has an ID, a region, a zone, and a category, right? So I can define a scope on my singleton attribute saying region and zone.
Mm-hmm.
And so this means that all queue messages in region west will be executed sequentially. All queue messages in region east will be executed sequentially, but messages between east and west will be executed in parallel.
Okay.
So it,
makes sense.
It maintains, yeah, oh, perfect.
Yeah, yeah, no,
it,
I mean,
it took me three tries to get it, so I was pretty excited when I got it.
Yeah.
So I'll sort of demonstrate this behavior to you. You know, I'll sort of enqueue these queue messages. and I think it's a pretty good enhancement because it's very hard to sort of write singleton in the cloud.
Sure.
And so this is West. Let me add one more West. And I'll now add an East over here as well. And I'm going to add one more West with a zone of 1 so that we can differentiate it. So I've added 4 messages, 3 are in West, 1 is in East. So you'll see the East and the West being executed in parallel, and the ones in West will be executed sequentially because we'll take a lock on it.
And but the ones in the, so the zones, since there's one in zone 2 and one in zone 1 in West, will those be executed in parallel as well?
Yes.
So we'd really have 3 being executed in parallel, and the second message for zone 2 in the West would wait.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And I'm going to launch it. And so this is just verbose logging on, you know, what functions did we detect, sort of how did we index them. And it's now saying like queue messages were detected. So you'll start to see the logs up here. So you say West 1, East 2, West 1, East 2 in parallel. And you'll see that West 2 is going sequentially. And behind the scenes, we'll also keep renewing the lock.
Mm-hmm.
So in some cases, there are functions which are long running. And so in those cases, you just want to keep renewing the lock until the function like sort of completes. And you have knobs to configure like how long do you want to wait for until the function sort of times out and stuff.
Okay.
yeah, so you'll basically see like, you know, in region west, zone 1, region east, zone 2, and then region west, zone 2. But the west ones were sort of the ones in the same region and zone were executed sequentially, and ones that were in different zones were executed in parallel as well.
Cool. Very powerful.
So that's, yeah, that's pretty cool. So that's a sort of new addition that we did. I also sort of wanted to, you know, now that I've shown you all the extensibility work, we do have samples that you can refer to on the GitHub repo, which
Great.
Sort of just brain dead, how do I get started? With writing extensions. And what I'm going to show you now is as part of this work, you know, the whole extensible model opening up so that, you know, you can use these in your functions. We also introduced a way of scheduling functions, scheduling jobs inside the web jobs Kudu framework as well.
Okay.
And
can you remind us what the Kudu stuff is?
Yeah, so Kudu is sort of the backend that powers the Azure web apps. That's the deployment engine. It's the source control engine. And it's got a bunch of diagnostics tools that you can use to manage your web app. Like, you know, if you're going to process dump, it has a command line shell. It has a dashboard where you can see, like, what's your memory usage like across your console EXE. So that's basically what Kudu is. And
okay.
Kudu, in fact, is the backend engine for web jobs, per se. Like,
great.
So what we've done is, like, you know, we've taken the same features that we've added in the SDK around, like, how do I specify a schedule using cron expressions? And we've sort of given you a way, if you are a sort of non-.NET developer, to create these jobs and then define a schedule for them.
Okay.
The only requirement is that these require your web apps to be on always on. So I think it's shared, like, standard and above is what you need to be on.
Okay.
And so I'm going to just quickly show you an example of such a job. So I just have a batch file here, like demo.batch. I'm just going to print out the time, hello world cloud cover. And then I have this settings.job file. So I'm defining the schedule, like again, the same cron expression that I was using the SDK. And you can use this settings.job file for more things. So let's say if you've scaled out your web jobs to multiple instances, mm-hmm. and you only want to run on one, you can say, like, is singleton equals true?
So okay.
It'll run only on one instance.
Great.
And then I can, you know, I'll just delete the zip. So I can just create a zip file which has all these, has my bad job. Mm-hmm. I can go back to the entire Azure Web Apps portal.
Mm-hmm.
I go to the web jobs features. Now, if you're a Visual Studio developer, like you would just right-click your console .exe and publish as Azure Web Job.
Right.
But since I'm uploading a batch file, I can upload it via a portal upload where I can upload a zip file. So I can say demo job. I'm going to run it on demand mm-hmm. because it's running on a schedule.
Yep.
And I can just upload a file over here. Settings.job. So create. So it's going to upload the zip file. In the back end, Kudu is going to listen for file notifications, unzip, and here my job is ready. I can run it. And then I can go to the dashboard for web jobs. And I can see this web job demo job, which I just uploaded. And you'll see a history sort of keep appear over here. Like it's going to run every 5 seconds. And each invocation, you know, I can drill down and basically see the output of it, like which was the Hello World cloud cover.
So basically, when you say go ahead and run this, it's the you know it's then looking at that settings file and saying this is the cron schedule I want to run on, and now I'm going to run the job, the
exactly,
batch file.
Exactly.
Great.
And since my cron schedule was run every 5 seconds, so I just like ran it, like versus if you had like run every Sunday, then like wait for that
sure.
time to kick.
We can record
stuff.
Until Sunday. I think we're not doing anything, right, guys?
But you know that's just another way of sort of specifying a schedule. It keeps your schedule close to your web job. And so this works for any platform, Node, Python,
right.
PowerShell, Ruby, even the console .exe as well if you're not using the SDK.
Right.
If you're using the SDK, then you get the benefits of defining different kinds of functions that you can trigger on different events as well.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, that's pretty much what I wanted to sort of show you guys today was sort of the that we've opened up, you know, the SDK.
Mm-hmm.
We've sort of opened up the extensibility model, like based on the feedback that we've been hearing. Like there are folks who want to have triggers for like SQL, like you know, storage and like FTP-based yep. triggers and stuff. So if you guys are interested, you know, I would strongly encourage you to check out the links. You know, we have lots of samples. We have a few docs that we are working on. And we have examples of like timers and files that you can sort of leverage and sort of use these triggers. And it really does improve the developer experience because you know now we can have a single EXE and I can have different functions being
yeah.
triggered based on different events. And then I can just deploy as one EXE.
I have a question though. At the beginning of the show, you mentioned there were two extension points, the triggers and the binders. Are you going to talk about binders this time?
So binders is the, let me show you an example. So let me go back to my project. So that's a good point that you mentioned. So let's look at files, for example, right? So when we say triggers, we mean like how is the function being executed? Like is it being executed on a new queue message or a new file or mm-hmm. a new file in a blob or a new service bus queue message? And binders are when the function gets triggered, how does the function get the payload of the message?
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, you're seeing I'm binding to a file and I'm getting a stream. And I'm writing to a blob. So these are binders, basically. So yes, you can write your own binders as well as you steam fit. So good examples are, for example, we've added a bunch of extensible point for tables as well. So given a queue message, like let's say you want to bind to an IEnumerable of table, or let's say some folks that I've asked for is, so I have a blob container which has you know 10 files.
Mm-hmm.
So today what we support is you can only bind to a single file, so you get a stream. But folks, users have asked for, I want to bind to an iCollection of files mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. container,
okay.
so I can process them easily. So those are the kind of binder extensibility that you know anybody can write. So mm-hmm. we've not written yet. We have a few backlog items that are there in our backlog that we'll sort of eventually get to it and produce sort of samples on it. But yes, so that's an extensibility point for binders where, so now you can be very fancy on how do you want to receive the response of a trigger, or how do you want to receive this information from your sort of trigger source pretty much. So yes, that's, mm-hmm. And you can do sort of neat things as well. You know, like in this, for example, I'm saying parenthesis name, which is saying match this pattern for any files that blob container. Mm-hmm. So you get this functionality for free as a framework author as well.
Great.
And the other thing I should have mentioned as well, like as part of the open source effort, we also have the dashboard like this that we've open sourced.
Okay.
The benefit of that is like now you can sync the open source repo, build it locally, and run the dashboard locally.
Oh, great.
So you can completely have like an offline sort of not connected to the cloud experience where you're launching your console apps locally, you're like watching the dashboard, you know, and then seeing what basically in your local machine what's happening.
So it sounds like this would be an easy way to potentially get the same experience on premise as well as in the cloud, where since you can run this dashboard in your own computer in your data center, you could be running the same jobs since both places are same experience.
Yep. Great. And because web jobs are nothing but like console EXEs.
Right, exactly.
So you can run this as a Windows service.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Well, I love seeing us open source stuff, so I'm really excited to see what people are able to do with this and what sort of extensions we see going forward. Where should we send people if they have more questions or they want to get a hold of somebody that knows something?
My Twitter handle is RUSTD.
Okay.
That's the main link that you guys should remember, like failure responses on that. And we'll have links in our post towards
perfect.
So do definitely check out those links. I think they'll be super useful.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on, Pranav. I really appreciate you showing us all the new exciting stuff coming out of WebJobs.
Thank you.
And we look forward to seeing what's going to come in the future.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, thanks, everybody, for watching. And we will see you next time on Cloud Cover Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.